Hello, everyone, and welcome to another long overdue episode of Yes Sir, HR. My name is Mark, and I'm together with...
Yes, you're with me again, Mark. It's me, Dennis, from a very sunny Jersey. Funny enough, as I speak to you now, I'm sitting in the lounge, and my apartment sort of overlooks the sea. Beautiful sandy beach, blue sky, and the sun is shining. So life is certainly better than in January.
Okay, cool. It seems that we both seem to have forgotten how to do a podcast. Because I think this has been quite a while since we had one. And the reason is being because you and I have both been caught up with a number of things. You also having to make a trip to Cambodia. And how was that? What was that about?
Absolutely brilliant. Really amazed with Cambodia. It's now a very modern city in many respects. Yep. Lots of nice places to eat. You can see the infrastructure's there, very good internet, but it's still got a very friendly kind of feel about it. It hasn't sort of got saturated with tourists and lost some of the appeal of, you know, other places. So, yeah, and the people I worked with, it was Royal University of Phnom Penh, as you know, faculty was superb, highly motivated. And I think Cambodia really is somewhere that could have an excellent educational system. It's committed to training teachers. The teachers seem highly motivated. And I look forward to going back a number of times over the next 2 or 3 years. Absolutely fabulous.
Right. Okay. I'm glad that you had a good time in Cambodia. And I think there is room for potential further work in Cambodia. And I think we might be spending some time there. But for today, actually, what I wanted to do or what I wanted to talk about a little bit more is not Manchester United finishing above Spurs. What I actually wanted to talk about was really to dig a little bit deeper about AI, generative... I forgot the actual full name. I'm pretty sure you know. What does GPT stand for?
Generative robotic GPT technology, I think. Robotic technology. Yeah, we just think of ChatGPT as an artificial intelligence model. It seems to be able to do a lot of work for us, but with some limitations and creating quite a bit of global controversy about its impacts on humanity and in particular teaching and learning.
Yep. So I know we did talk about it briefly. And actually today, I want to dive a little bit more deeply and to look at ChatGPT as a whole. I think even Google has released their own version of their AI called Bard, B-A-R-D. And apparently it is slightly superior to ChatGPT because it actually now has the concept of checking its work through the internet. And ChatGPT has a limitation because all the knowledge is only up to 2021. And unless you're on version 4, which is a paid version, then you are given the access for ChatGPT to check the internet. Now, what we are going to focus on today is this idea of assessment redesign for generative AI. And what we want to talk a little bit about is how do we grapple with assessment, not only in the delivering of assessment, but even in the design of assessment. Because when ChatGPT first came out, everybody was saying, oh, we should ban it because it's going to compromise our examinations and so forth. But as you know, it is almost impossible to ban technology from the classrooms. Is it a fair statement to say that?
Absolutely. I mean, we're wasting our time to look at this thing as something that we can ban completely because it's there. A lot of people will want to access it. And firms, companies, whatever it is, irrespective of what governments do, unless it's absolutely draconian, it's gonna be there. We've got to deal with it. And I actually think there's more positives than negatives, frankly.
Right. Okay. So what we want to talk a little bit about is really to look at, and this article that I sent you, where they talk about how we can really explore various strategies for modifying assessment tasks. so that we can address both the defensive side, which is to prevent cheating, but more importantly, also so that we can exploit the various affordances of ChatGPT as a technology. So I wanted to go through this, and they have suggested six things that we should think about. And then we'll go through one. We'll go through them one by one. So number one, yeah. What they have said is, when we talk about assessment redesign or we ChatGPT, the first things we can do is we can actually ignore it. Okay. Number two, we can actually ban it. Number three, we can actually invigilate it. Number four, we can embrace it. Number five, we can design around it. And number six, we can rethink. Now, I'm more interested in number six, which is rethink. And I would like to tap your thinking behind this and also your expertise. But let's go through this one by one. So let's talk about ignore. Now, in terms of ignore, what they are suggesting is to simply ignore this development and really bury your head in the sand like an ostrich so that it actually goes away. And this is quite interesting because some people actually believe that generative AI will not significantly impact education. And they have cited a long history of hype around various educational technologies such as tablet computers, electronic whiteboards, and MOOCs. And they believe that generative AI may go the same way as some of these technologies. So what do you think? Is it wise for us to just ignore it in terms of from the assessment perspective? Or what should we be doing?
Well, this notion that it's going to just go away because certain things in the past in technology have not really lived up to expectations. And let's go back here, because I think it's important for you know, people who listen in to get a bit of an historical context. And we try to be meaty and evidence-based. That I remember when I was in Singapore and online learning was the best thing since sliced bread. It was a learning revolution. People were writing books about it. And I looked at it and I thought, well, not really. It's a bit like, you know, when Louis, was it Stevenson who invented the train? Okay. And it was called the Rocket. And I think it went at 26 miles an hour. And at the time, people said, oh, you can't have something driving, you know, being driven so fast. It's all wrong. Well, let's be honest about it. We're now talking about intergalactic travel 40 or 50 years down the line. There are things in technology that were unfounded maybe 30 years ago, the learning revolution. It was slow. There was bandwidth issues. To develop anything took years of coding. And at that time, it wasn't mature. Now, when we talk about learning today, the blended format, where you've got good pedagogic design, both online and in face-to-face. We've got a lot of free technologies. Every week you come up with a new free tool.
Yep.
And things work much quicker. You can stream video. So the age of the interactive video is now. It wasn't the case 30 years ago. Now, this notion that an intelligent agent like ChatGPT that at the language model level can access all the language and pull together lots of good information. Yes, it's not fully current and it doesn't access the internet yet, but these technologies will not only be accessing language, they'll be accessing every single bit of data that exists on the planet and pulling that together and packaging it for us. Yes, will it always be 100%? No. But think about it. To be able to go to a tool and say, right, give me a compare and contrast of three major educational theories, behaviorism, cognitivism, constructivism, identify the key premises, the similarities and differences and assumptions, the main writers and the evidence supports it, sources that support this. Wow, that is going to change the learning process. And that's the big issue, that teachers are standing in classrooms today, and they still are, and they're showing 54 PowerPoint slides, often boring, and students are copying this down or looking it over. It's educational Jurassic Park. I mean, and as you know, I've written a few chapters on that. And this is really going to go back, not, I think, before the Jurassic period. Was it the Crustacean period? If people are doing that, because students aren't going to sit in lectures when you've got ChatGPT, and you can create your own avatar, make it look what you like. You can keep talking to it 24/7. It can pull information from all over the world. Then we're going to be teaching a lot less. However, I remember in Singapore, we talked about, or the government talked about in particular, and I thought they were really clever on this, teach less, learn more. We yep. certainly don't. We can now teach less. Students can certainly learn more if we teach them how to learn. And that's where a number of things have to come together here. If we're giving students, we're empowering them to understand how the mind works and the brain to some extent, and that they can develop good critical thinking skills, good metacognitive capability. They can deal with this information. They may not understand it all. And that's where going into the classroom, the face-to-face tutorials, and teachers are very skillful at summarizing information, know the subject well, help students see fact from opinion, become significant, which means that there's more time to devote to the assessment process. Because one of the big problems is if teachers are teaching 20 hours a week and they've got other work to do, etc., and more admin work to do, particularly in the UK, I observe, you know, the one of the big complaints that comes across from everybody I speak to in the UK is there's so many other stuff that teaching is almost a kind of add-on. I mean, slight exaggeration, but it's a strong feeling that a lot of teachers want to leave the profession. So now there's an opportunity for skillful teachers who don't have to teach as many contact hours in a traditional sense, but can actually digest the subject matter and be much more facilitative in the way they get students to learn and have more time to do authentic assessment. So there's a bit of a summary for you.
Okay, so basically what we are saying is you can't just bury your head in the sand. You can't ignore it. But at the same time, I think what we can do is, and what we have been advocating in the podcast for the longest time, is to really try and link it to evidence-based teaching and learning principles. But is that what we are trying, basically trying to say, right?
Well, absolutely, because what we know, I mean, Daniel Willingham, you know, in my opinion, one of the best writers in the field, talks about teacher education, moving away from teaching all these bits of theory, Vygotsky, and a bit of constructivism, a bit of behaviorism. There's only one theory of learning. And funny enough, I did an article in the Jersey Evening Post that went in this week to basically say that teachers simply need to know what are the key things about how humans learn and what teaching methods work best, and then spend the time developing the skill over time with good deliberate practice. And what we know about professional development has got to be sustained over time with expert feedback. So it's an opportunity now for teachers to really get very good at the skill of teaching. I mean, the analogy, because we like football, it's a really simple game. It's not that difficult to understand. You know, and let's be honest about it, me and you, we could do probably better than what Lineker and some of these guys do. But the big difference is they were professional footballers. So when they say things like, well, you need to get the ball, people go, wow, if we said that, they say, who are those two bozos? So the kind of point is that we now, with the technology, this is this, you know, if you like, there's an educational singularity that for a long time, pedagogy was in a dark place, in my opinion. You know, the educational Jurassic Park, every 10 years it goes from traditional to progressive, and then the teacher's the sage on the stage, then the guide on the side. It really doesn't convince anybody that teaching is a profession with solid evidence bases like, you know, medicine and engineering. But now we know a lot more about the learning process, and we've got a technology now, things not just ChatGPT, but interactive videos, augmented reality, and so many more kind of additional plug-in features that we've now got the singularity. We really do know how students learn and people learn much more than yesteryear, not completely, and that research is ongoing. And we've now got technology that is, you know, quite ubiquitous. It's there, the Internet of Things. So the skill and the direction of teaching has got to be evidence-based teaching with a fairly good IT literacy. They don't have to do coding, but they need to know what these IT tools do and how they can impact the learning process in positive ways. And creative teachers will get that blend, and that would be the gold standard of teaching. And that's something we may need to do a couple of podcasts on further down the line.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's something for us to think about. So that's the first one, which is ignore. So we can't do that. Now, the second option on the table is to actually attempt to ban these technologies. And of course, if you it's like almost taking a hammer to kill an ant. While I'm not suggesting that the ant is AI technologies, but I think what most people are concerned about is ChatGPT can be used as a tool to cheat in our examination. And consider the fact that we are now moving away from highly proctored examinations to more take-home assignments, the first initial thought is to ban, because actually students have found ways to bypass these bans. And I think also now it brings the debate about validity and reliability of various policing methods. So what do you think of this? Should we, like, one is ignore, that's not an option. So what about banning these kind of technologies to preserve the integrity and validity of our assessments?
Look, prohibition for long periods, try to ban alcohol. Good luck with that one. I mean, it's abundant. It's similar issues you could argue where something exists and people, for whatever reasons, desire it. Banning it only drives it underground, and then it becomes something else for the police to do. And believe me, in the UK, they've got more than enough to do. That if your house is burgled and you get a policeman to come round, you're doing really well. If we keep trying to ban more and more things, and I think that there's too many things that are banned now, and you know that's another conversation, and we don't get involved in those kind of things. But to try to ban this kind of technology that any IT expert or group of experts can start to do it in illegal situations, and then we've got arrests. It's just ridiculous, in my opinion, anyway, to try and ban it.
Okay. Yeah. So I think because I was just told a very interesting anecdote. That apparently when the Singapore Minister for Education was attending some conference in Europe, and they were all asking him what was Singapore's stand towards ChatGPT, and they were all saying that they were going to ban it from all the institutions, and he said Singapore is embracing it. Apparently it created quite a stir in the education circles there.
Well, mate, you know me. I am an advocate of the Singapore education system. I've said many times, and I've written this a number of times as well. Singapore education system, in my opinion, and we could argue what the criteria are, and I think they're evidence-based anyway, is the best education system in the world. And sadly, there is other societies and systems that seem to want to just kind of dig into turf issues because it suits people in high positions and jobs, whereas Singapore breaks the mold on that. It was a privilege to work in Singapore for 25 years, and I still work with people like you, and it's a great system, and there's a lot of really, really good professionals in that system, and they're always looking to improve. It's transparent. It makes perfect sense to me. So good for Singapore for saying that and not just following the dross of other less informed folk.
Okay. So that's something for us to think about. So banning is not really an idea. Students also can actually find a way to circumvent the ban. And I'm just saying that we are only just talking about ChatGPT. There's others such as Bard, as I talked about. And if you just type generative AI tools, there are like thousands.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost impossible to... It's like a whack-a-mole kind of situation. You ban one, mm-hmm. there'll be another one that will pop up. It's almost impossible to ban it completely. Now, the third option is to design assessments that obviously circumvent the use of AI. And of course, this one was something that came to me quite immediately. One of the obvious approach is to revert back to traditional exam settings where students are monitored and then there's browser blocks. And then they produce written artifacts. So the point here is some people are advocating going back to writing as the default assessment approach in all circumstances, and then put them in a room and then basically lock them up and throw away the key. Is that something that we should be thinking about for our assessments as we continue to embrace generative AI?
Well, look, there's probably people that would want to go back to riding horses rather than motorized vehicles. In certain cases, if you're going through kind of forestry, an horse would probably be better than a Range Rover. Oh, maybe a Range Rover might be able to do it, but the average car. Look, I don't think when we say going back, you know, there's this kind of notion that going back is a bad thing. I don't think it is. I mean, I'd like to go back to the music of the 60s and 70s rather than this kind of nonsense rap and techno music that seems to dominate the landscape. But you could get into a big subjective argument with that. Well, if we talk about traditional exams, if we're saying we want students sitting down with no access to resources and doing just largely memory-based recall written tests. No, we don't want to do that. But the idea of invigilating means that the people are doing it under conditions where they can't access ChatGPT or their uncle or auntie's got a PhD in the subject or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It can be an open book type exam where students can access certain resources, and you could say, well, GPT isn't one of those in certain situations, and make the assessments much more real-world based one, authentic assessment. Make sure that the test items are not just ones that come up every year so students can memorize them anyway. And that would be bad without ChatGPT, but where they have to show understandings of key concepts, key principles, use skills. And ChatGPT can't give you a skill, it can only give you knowledge. So that's the big question. We've got to focus the assessment on skills, whether they are cognitive skills or psychomotor skills or effective aspects of analysis and application. So to me, that is the major solution, is the way we design the assessment environment, the items. And to me, that is well doable. And when we go on to rethink, which I think is the sixth one, that's something that we will go back to. So for me, yes, we need to go back to invigilated, authentic situations that stop students plagiarizing. Because at the moment, they can, even without ChatGPT, you can get people to write essays for you at any level. You can these take home exams, at the end of the day, I would reduce take home stuff for formative assessment anyway, and go back virtually, not in all cases, for not necessarily for 100% of the assessment, but I think we need to go back to more assessment being done under examination conditions. And all this, to me, nonsense. Oh, it's stressful. Look, life is stressful. And if we're going to start, I mean, it's getting to a stage where the schools in the UK, we don't have competitive teams anymore. Everybody, you play sport and nobody wins. It's everybody gets a medal. Well, life isn't like that. So there's a lot of dangerous nonsense flying around, in my opinion. You know, there's a bit of a, I find it at best amusing, but at worst kind of dangerous nonsense. So let's get back to getting students to take responsibility to learn stuff, but learn to think and apply. And that changes what we teach and how we teach it.
Yeah, I think that's important that you brought that up. Because so far, we've been talking about stuff that teachers need to do. And one of it is, like I said, we ignore it, we ban it, or we invigilate it. And I'm glad you actually brought up the part about students will also need to play their part in actually this whole entire process. It's not something that we do to students, but something that students will also need to participate actively in the whole assessment process. Which brings us to the fourth option, which is to embrace generative AI in assessments. And this could range from allowing or requiring students to use AI in specific tasks to having them critique, update, or assess AI-generated artifacts for themselves. And I think a wide range of options is emerging, okay, as generative AI is likely to increasingly impact how people work and live. So my question to you would be some people are suggesting that we should embrace it. And I know I'm repeating myself, but I think it's important. It requires students to use AI in specific tasks to have them critique, update, or assess AI-generated artifacts themselves. Now, before I get you to share your thoughts, I'm going to put you in a bit of a spot here.
Yeah.
How, I'm not sure if you have done it with your own students, but if you have, good. If not, then how would you get your students to embrace generative AI in assessments in your own classroom?
Well, this word embrace, it's kind of, I just find it a bit of a fluffy term. It's kind of, it's a bit... I've got to be careful what I say because this goes out globally. We don't have to use words like embrace. It has connotations of hugging and kissing and, I miss you already kind of sort of sophistry, right? We've got to look at it and say, here is something that exists. There are ways in which this could be very productive for life in general. Again, the same applies to how we apply it in society. If we're just going to use it for companies to make as much profit as possible and lay people off work and not give them any kind of meaning in their lives, that's going to be a really dangerous thing. A route for artificial intelligence. So equally, if it's done in ways that improve people's living standards, it comes up with solutions for better energy solutions, et cetera, et cetera. Then it could be a boon for humanity. So it's a bit like the gun, is the gun a good or bad thing? Well, for the psychopaths who go around shooting people, it's a bad thing, but for defending against some kind of psychotic dictator, it may be a good thing. So the kind of point is I see AI very much in those terms. It's a bit like drugs, isn't it? Well, when drugs are used to improve people's suffering, they're good. When they're used for people to get in addictive, dangerous states, they're not good. So I see it in exactly the same kind of light. So, we need to accept it, but we need to apply good thinking. And this is important. And sadly, I don't think enough of the world's population, and including the leaders, seem to be terribly good at good thinking. So that's worrying. But yeah, with good thinking, it can be done. With poor thinking, it has dangers, limitations, etc.
Okay. So I think that's why... in my opinion, if we can use generative AI and we can allow students to embrace it. But I think it's not just the end in itself. It's probably about teaching them about how to analyze it, how to critically assess it. And that's another teaching skill. And I know we've talked about this quite a fair bit in previous episodes. That's a teaching skill that I think some of our teachers, lecturers, instructors will need to start to think about. Because honestly, really, the teaching of content, while again, don't get me wrong, is might be important, generative AI might be able to do a job, a better job or a faster job than you can. And my point would be is why actually try and flog a dead horse? Wouldn't it make more sense to teach students to be more critical in their thinking, more critical in their acceptance of what generative AI has created? Does that make sense?
Absolutely, that's really spot on, and it's something I think we have to keep reifying in our podcast, because there is a real kind of sort of paradigm war in education, and between sort of radical social constructivists and people like us, John Atty, people like Daniel Williams, and the cognitive science folk, where we know that we have got to be more able to be objective and subjective and accept these two dimensions that ultimately, of course, things are subjective, as the social constructivists would let us have, but it ain't all subjective. You know, it's a bit like when we talk about how many genders there are and, you know, the differences between males and females and the kind of identity politics that Jordan Peterson talks about on his podcast. I mean, he's spot on those kind of things. But at the same time, we have got to recognise that anything we want to implement will have some opposition, and we've got to be tolerant of criticism, you know, on whatever paradigm we're in. But the paradigm of evidence-based, I think, is the sounder one. That let's look at the evidence, let's critically analyse it. And this applies, we want students to be able to look at ChatGPT with a way of saying, look, there's a lot of information here, and but it needs to be carefully analysed, evaluated, and not just taken as stuff that we can use to pass our exam. There needs to be a real change in the student focus. And it's not just developing their cognitive capability. Yeah, metacognition is fundamental. But also, I think there's another area that we have to address, and that is the way we bring our children up. Now, parenting's a big issue and complex, and we won't go there. But schools have got to teach consistently what I would call core values of human conduct. And it's not political correctness stuff. It's about integrity, honesty, hard work and responsibility, not about rights. So there has to be another big paradigm shift there. Content is fundamentally important. We want students have got to get content in the right combinations to have in their long-term memory systems and neurologically wired. So there isn't an argument about content versus process, subject content knowledge and thinking. They go together, but we can't get students to engage in ridiculous amounts of content. We've got to focus on key concepts and principles, and then students will then, once they've got that, with good thinking, they will pull in the concept knowledge and be able to see the wood from the trees. So there's no conflict between this knowledge and thinking argument that's gone on for decades. It's now applying principles, cognitive science principles, to learning and getting students to take more responsibility and teachers to be better at facilitating the learning process.
Okay, so thanks for that. And I think the fifth one that we need to talk about is to design assessments around the limitations of generative AI. And this really involves exploiting the weaknesses of AI technologies. However, they also acknowledge that as AI becomes more sophisticated and they become smarter, it almost seems to be futile in trying to design around AI. Fair comment?
You're absolutely right. There's nothing else to say. it's a redundant concept, as some of these are. Ignore we cannot do, ban it we can't do. Embrace it is a bit of a fluffy term, for I'd rather, you know, kind of replace that with some other term. But we've got to look at it, identify the positive affordances, look at the underpinning valuations, look at the limitations, look at the implications of those limitations and where it's not used properly, and to try to get more things on the positive side of that spectrum.
Okay, so which brings us to the last one, and I think we need to spend a little bit of time talking about this, and that is rethinking assessment entirely. Now, what they are suggesting is this challenging approach requires really asking how and why students are assessed in the first place. And they are suggesting that if assessments feel like chores and they do not encourage creativity or inspire actual learning, then we are doomed to have ChatGPT as the tool that is really going to essentially just mean that whatever assessments we design are effectively meaningless. Okay, so maybe what we need to think about is, when we talk about the way we rethink assessment, what would be some of the things that we need to rethink about, but at the same time not messing up the principles of assessment? So I don't know if you have had time to think about this, but let's have a little bit of a conversation around it. What does rethinking assessment really mean in today's context?
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, we can't see assessment separated from teaching and learning. As David Perkins said, it's one seamless thing. So it's not just about tinkering with the assessment system. We've got to look at the old curriculum. There's one of the big criticisms of the UK curriculum, apart from the fact that for a lot of people, they think it's broken in so many ways, because students are expected to learn more and more stuff for tests, more and more. And there's now a big movement to really say, hold on a minute, we can't keep doing this. Because what are we ending up? We're ending up with more and more assessments, so schools can be appraised by Ofsted, which has also come under massive criticism at the moment. And the issue is we're trying to do something that it doesn't really make any sense. Instead of focusing on key competencies and capability in those competencies, it seems to be this ridiculous notion of more is better, and it's not. Better is better. And also there is a kind of bureaucracy, and there is a paradigm underpinning it, which is almost non-discussable. You talk about freedom of speech. I don't mind saying that you said to me is that, you know, compare England, the UK and Singapore on freedom of speech. You've got a lot more freedom of speech over there. I spent 25 years in Singapore, and I've lived in the UK as long. And yeah, I think we used to have more freedom of speech, but I don't think it's the case now in the UK. It's anyway, to get back on that focus, the thing is, let's take a subject like English, right? Okay, we're noting that lots of kids are coming out of school, they can't write properly, they can't read, they can't speak properly, they can't self-regulate. Well, hold on a minute. These kids are spending 15,000 hours in school. Michael Rutter's book, the title of that was 15,000 hours, I believe. So what are we teaching kids? It's probably, you could probably get rid of, I don't know what percentage of content, but we should be focusing in English, getting kids to be able to read, let them read what they're interested in and build the vocabulary and the grammar up around that. Let them write about it, but teach them good structure and get them to talk about it. And let's teach them how to speak clearly, expressively, in an organized manner, use emphasis, understand body language. So, and let's assess those things. Yeah. And what that basically means is we're assessing performance, and GBT can't interfere with that. If we're going to assess students' ability to write, get them to write stuff under exam conditions. Don't say to me, oh, if a student says, oh, I can't write, well, what does that mean? Don't tell me you can't write unless you can't write. Don't say you can't write because I'm in an exam room. It's our students, right? You've got some information here. Write a 1,000-word synopsis of this, but with some criteria of showing their ability to analyze, make inferences from data. And if you want them to speak, get them to speak. So I don't see really this as such a big problem. But when you look at the curriculum level, we've got to start teaching kids stuff that's relevant, and we've got to assess the skills and the underpinning understanding. So if a student does a presentation and it's good, if you want to assess the underpinning knowledge, ask them why they did this and not did that, what basis, so you can assess it. It's a kind of competency framework, but making sure the competencies are most relevant and not made complicated because it suits some agency that are going to profit from making something that is not that complicated complicated.
Okay,
so that's it. That's the fundamental premise.
I'm going to offer something that's a little bit more controversial, okay. Because that's something that I was reading, and I'll send you the paper. It says which I thought was actually quite interesting, and it says assessment in the age of artificial intelligence. And one of the things that the authors are suggesting is this idea of stealth assessment. So one of the things that we have always talked about is, oh, we wanted to look at process and not necessarily the product. And why do we not do that? It's because it's time consuming, it's difficult to define, it's difficult to come up with standards. But now with the invention of artificial intelligence, this idea of stealth assessments where we actually track students' movements, eye movements, the way they move the mouse, could be something as a sort of like insight to the way that they are actually learning. And I know this is like Total Recall, Terminator kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. What do you think of such things? I think there are a lot of ethical issues behind it, but I would love to hear your thoughts. This idea of stealth assessment.
Well, it does, put it this way, it worries me a little bit. Like, remember, I did kind of get trained in neuro-linguistic programming, and neuro-linguistic programming does help one do certain things. Like, for example, very much the skill of sensory acuity, which is to observe behavior in situ at subtle levels, the way people move their eyes, the change of tone, pauses, and various kind of, if you like, body movement features. And it's certainly useful. And I've done quite a bit of work sitting in interviews and looking at the process. And I've looked at some candidates who are there, and I think I wouldn't employ you in a month of Sundays. Okay, one piece of data, right? I would look at other data, but there's something that just about their behavior, their tone suggests that they are not being that authentic in situation. But I've seen, you know, professionals, principals, and that say, oh, what a great candidate. And they've employed them. And I've said, well, it's up to you. And in most cases where I've said, I'm not particularly happy with employing that candidate, and they've wanted them, in many cases, I've been rung up, sometimes only weeks after they've been appointed, and said, Dennis, we're having trouble with this person. Can you help us out? And I've said, well, no. I was in there. I said, I wouldn't employ that person, and you wanted to employ him. Now, there's a reason why I wouldn't have employed him. And it's easier to change people than what it is to change people. Now, think about that one. Why do you think Manchester City are so successful? Why do you think Eddie Howe's been so successful at Newcastle? One is the integrity of the person, the skill of the person, the integrity that I think, you know, he's shown, and that's coming from a lot of sources. And the honesty of saying to people, you need to improve and get them to buy into how to do that. And I think he's probably a pretty good coach in terms of developing, you know, mindsets, which you need, the attitudinal aspect, but also developing the skills. And that's why they play like they do.
Right.
And I think that needs to be looked at and, you know, employed in all organisations, because it's based on very fundamental ways in which people behave. Now, going back to the stealth assessment, it would be, I would not want, it's like criteria reference interviewing, Mark. It sounds good, or we've got all the criteria, but you've got to look at the criteria holistically. I mean, I've used it in competency-based teacher education programs in different countries. And what I found, that sometimes I'm ticking the boxes just, in other words, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, and they meet the criteria. Other people perhaps have not met some criteria, you know, the font size has not been right or something, but I'd employ them all day long. So I don't want to get caught up in this kind of attempt to make human behavior into an algorithm, because it isn't. It's heuristic at best. It's like our core principles of learning. They are not algorithms, but they're very strong heuristics. In other words, it is typically the case, if you don't find out what students already know, it does affect the effectiveness of your instruction. So, however, for one or two students, it might not matter. So we've got to work on strong heuristics. So if we're talking about looking at a range of evidence sources, including some of this, if you like, kind of psychometric neuroscience combination type stuff. I don't want to go that route as the new objectivity, like, you know, intelligence tests, you know, they're objective. Well, their IQ is a very valid measurement of someone's general capability, but it's only one piece of evidence. And simply employing someone because they've got an higher IQ, it doesn't make any sense. it's certainly the case that you want higher IQs in certain types of jobs, but we tend to know that people with IQs of around 125 to 128 with good social intelligence tend to be better all round than people who are off the rails with 169 or whatever. Generalization, but it's a valid one.
Right.
I think.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's emerging, something that we need to keep an eye, our eye on. And then we can talk about it as we go along. So, yeah. So, essentially, we only just scratched the surface of AI generative assessments. And a lot more things will start to come to the fore as we continue to adopt and embrace this technology. And I'm certainly one looking forward to it. And I'm also trying to figure out about this rethinking of assessments, but to make it a bit more interesting for students, but at the same time, not compromising on the rigor and integrity of assessments as a whole. Yeah. So that's something that I think we can talk about in future episodes. So for now, let's jump straight into maybe segment two, which is where we share something that you may have read, something that we have found interesting, and something that we may have found inspiring as well. So I know we talked a little bit about Cambodia, so you can't use that again as an example. So anything that you found interesting and something that you may have read across then?
Read? What have I read recently? I've kind of got into going through YouTube and looking at all the science stuff, particularly about AI, because I'm still learning a lot of the nuances of that. Looking at, there's a lot of very good stuff on YouTube on all aspects of science and research. Again, one needs, it's a bit like ChatGPT, that one needs to have the literacy and the critical thinking, because some of it is unmitigated fluff. But there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, that's one thing that I'm doing. The other thing is I've been doing a piece of research to look at our students' experience, an evidence-based program tailored to developing self-directed learning capability, also self-efficacy as a learner. And that would be teaching them the core principles of learning, but focused to a student's point of view. So that piece of research is now finished and the data's coming in. So that's quite exciting, because if we can see clearly that a intervention of evidence-based learning focused to developing more student agency, that's going to be a significant piece of research that I may have to come over to Singapore and present at a conference, mate. So it's going to be tough, isn't it, for me to have to do that. So that's what I'm be doing. So I expect to be analysing the data and writing it up over the next couple of months, and looking to where I want to publish it and what conferences might be useful. So, yeah, I'm keeping busy. And also, I'm a granddad now, apparently.
Yeah, congratulations.
So I will meet my grandson on Friday. So, you know, that's been occupying a bit of time as well and thought. But, yeah, keeping very positive. And as I said, we have got to be optimistic and proactive. And otherwise, you know, where do we go as, you know, as a educational entity? We've got to believe that if we improve teachers and learners, that contributes something meaningful to, you know, the people talk about the carbon footprint. We can talk about perhaps the pedagogic footprint. Maybe that's something that we want to weave into our kind of philosophy, you know, to leave a good pedagogic footprint on the profession and the way people think about teaching and learning. And it's not just a cognitive issue, but it's equally a effective one and a behavioral one. And it's not just about getting jobs, it's about people's well-being, and it's about, you know, global survival, global well-being. So there.
Yeah, okay, cool. So my sharing is, I've told you I've been exploring quite a number of AI tools because I'm trying to cut short my learning curve. I found this one, which is a Google extension, and I'll put the link in the show notes. It's called Wise One. Now, Wise One is essentially touts to be an a Chrome extension. That means it exists in your browser. Helps you to master any topic you are reading online by bringing relevant and reliable information. So it is an AI-powered browser extension that offers new way of reading and exploring information. So it helps you to understand and learn about complex or unknown words, concepts, and people from the article that you are reading in itself. So it essentially it works in the background. If you hover over concepts or words that you are unsure about, it will then do a bit of a search to provide other articles and learning to help you learn that concept faster. Okay, so it actually helps to simplify the most complex information into understandable answers. You can basically ask any question about the article you are reading, and Wise One will generate a clear and concise answer. That's quite amazing, isn't it? So I tried it out. Yeah, it's free. I tried it out. While it's not perfect, I think it's quite a good way to interact with an article, especially if you wanted to find out what could be a hidden meaning or concept behind it. So I'll leave the link in the show notes so that some people who are interested can actually take and use it and try it out. And I would advise you to do that as well, then, because I know you read quite a lot. I'm not sure if you read papers online, but try Wise One so that you can actually interact with the article.
Yeah, no, that sounds... I mean, more we think about artificial intelligence, and apart from the generative robotic technologies, yeah, I think that's right. And all these extensions, once you start blending these together with good pedagogic literacy, you've really got some arsenal, haven't you, for both teaching and learning? Yep. And that's going to be, I think we need to write that book, Mark, before other people do it.
Okay, I promise you.
I'm not joking. I mean, many a true word spoken in jest. Yes. We'll have a conversation sometime, because these tools that you've looked at, I've been looking at some of them, and during the summer, I will go through every single tool that you've put up. I will go through it all, and I'll map it against cognitive scientific principles, and then we'll have a conversation about that.
Yeah, why not? Let's do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, that brings us an end to our long overdue episode of Yes, Sir, HR. And once again, if you want to write to us, please do so at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. And we would greatly appreciate it if you could share and put the link of this podcast in your socials, and then share it with someone whom you think may actually find it interesting to listen to us. So, yeah. What's the plan for the rest of the week, then?
What is it? It's Tuesday, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've got... I'll do a little bit of work on this project. I've got to write a column for the newspaper, so I'll probably do a bit on that. And I'm going to see my... grandson on Friday. I'm going to watch the cup final with my daughters and their partners on Saturday night. Have a curry. There's a curry house in Ealing that is probably one of the best value curry houses I've been to in the world. So, and I'll have a couple of Leffy beers as part of the celebration, and then move on till next week and see how the land lies with what I'm doing. And I'm going to take up rod and line fishing. I don't think I'm going to catch many fish because there aren't much around. But fishing is great for therapy, because you can throw your line out and you can sit there and you can do some work in your head, you know, thinking fast, thinking slow, the Kahneman stuff. You can get your mind into a nice slow thing. I'll have a notebook with me, and I can do that. So, and also, I'm a bit of a sun worshipper, as you know. I can sit out in the midday sun and get a suntan, get some vitamin D, not burn myself, let me add. And so I've got to relearn the art of rod and line fishing, which I used to do a lot as a kid with my dad, and great memories of that. So it will have a certain cathartic and therapeutic aspect to it.
Okay, perfect. Sounds like a good plan. So that brings us to an end of today's episode. So take care, everyone, and we'll speak to you soon. Take care and goodbye.
And goodbye from me, from a sunny Jersey.